Blog Talk Radio.
Home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Coming to you live from Hollywood, it's Rated G Radio with your host, Garrett Miller.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Rated G Radio. I am live for the next hour, and I'm thrilled that you are joining us tonight for an epic show of epic proportions. We are going to have, in the second half of the show, NBC Parks and Recreation star Jim O'Hare. He's going to be joining the show to talk about his new Kickstarter campaign for a movie that he has started, and it's called Middleman. It is really good, and the interview is super, super fun. I had a chance to do that with Jim over the weekend, and I know that you will want to stay tuned and hear all that he has to say. Our first guest is going to be Hollywood's, I'm going to call him a Hollywood hunk tonight because it's a Hollywood night, but he's the king of pop culture roulette, and his name is Greg Archer, and Greg will be on in just a little bit to talk about his new book, which is already a top 10 bestseller called Grace Revealed, and you will hear all about his journey through his family's trials and tribulations throughout World War II, but his journey to tell the story, and I'm really thrilled to have Greg here to tell you all about it. Before we get to that, though, today was a studio day for me, and it was one of those rare days where when I go to the studio, we didn't sing, we didn't play music, we didn't arrange music, but I worked with my A&R guy to work on, or really take a listen to the songs that I've been working on in the producer's studio for the last 6 months. And I'm really thrilled to tell you that out of the 11 songs, he really had only minor criticism for a couple. Tweak here, tweak there, change this, change that. And, of course, the one song that I thought, oh, this is just beautifully sung. It's all done. It's perfect. It's perfect. It's the ballad, because I hate ballads. I just don't want to sing ballads. And, of course, I sang this ballad on the new album that's coming out in May. And he said, it sounds unemotional. You sound detached. And here's your list of things that you needed to go to fix it. So I will be doing that in the coming weeks. But without further ado, let's get to Greg Archer, our king of pop culture roulette. He has joined the show again to talk about his new top 10 best-selling memoir called Grace Revealed. Greg, welcome back to the show. How are you?
I am wonderful. How are you tonight, Garrett? Thanks for having me on.
I am so thrilled that you are back to tell the listeners about your book. I have been reading the reviews on it. I've been reading articles on it. We've chatted a little bit about your book before, but I am thrilled that you are here to kind of give us the whole genesis of why you wrote the book, how you came to decide that this is the story that you wanted to tell, and everything that's happened since the book's been published. So how's your day? How's your week? What's been going on?
How's my day? How's my week? Well, I am sitting here talking to you in Chicago where it's a whopping 3 degrees.
Woo!
And I'm questioning my sanity. I'm kind of very curious. No, I'm kidding. It's a balmy 3 degrees here in Chicago, and I have such new respect for my my fellow Chicagoans who I grew up with, but fascinating, resilient people.
Well, you have to be if you're living in Chicago.
In California in March, huh?
Yeah, you'll thaw out. We're saving the thaw for until you get out here. So, yeah, we want to keep you nice and freeze-dried.
A few more weeks. But my day has been well, and my week has been evolving. Thank you, and I hope yours has been as well.
It's been crazy. So, well, because we could sit here and chit-chat about just, you know, us behind the scenes catching up and all the fun stuff that goes on, but you're really here to talk about your book called Grace Revealed. And I know a little bit about it, but would you do the listeners a favor and tell us everything? Why did you want to write a book? Now, I need to tell the listeners, number one, you've been a celebrity interviewer. You've already been a best-selling author for your other book. It was Shut Up, Skinny Bitches. You've been on TV. You've had your own TV show. You've been an editor. You've done all this stuff. And last year, well, a little over a year ago, you said, you know what? I'm going to toss it all away, and I'm going to do something different. What happened to make you do this?
Well, let's see what happened. I got a sign from, that's really kind of what happened. I've been wanting to write about this particular story for quite some time. I always grew up here, hearing my mother and my mother's side of the family talking about the experiences that they had during World War II or, in the 1940s and after World War II. And I was always fascinated by what I kept hearing, because I kept hearing that they were in, you know, these faraway lands. I heard, you know, words like, you know, Siberia and, you know, Uzbekistan and India and Karachi and Tanganyika, which is now Tanzania, Africa. And I was very, very curious about that. So my entire life, I really, you know, heard little bits of stories, you know, as I was growing up. I decided to ask more questions when I was in high school, and I found out the extent of what happened to them, and that they were among 2 million other Polish citizens who were deported by Stalin in the 1940s and sent to slave labor, and then later became refugees and wandered and eventually ended up in Africa, long and short of it. But I was very much fascinated with how they survived, how my grandmother kept everybody together, and how it all unfolded. So when I became an adult, I sort of vowed to research a little more, but I never really got around to it until about maybe over a decade ago. And once I sort of felt, I would say I felt haunted and hunted by their particular story. And I literally did what any Californian should and ought to do often. I asked for a sign on what I should do, and I got it, and it was a very clear indication of, you know, what I should do, and people can read about it in the book because it's in there. And it was to really explore my family's story more deeply. And so that's what I started to do about 10 years ago. Well, that's what I started to do really fully about, I would say, 2 or 3 years ago. And it's as if I really could not do it, you know, I had to do it.
Right.
So it felt like something was really gnawing at me, like I had to get it done. And so I just, you know, ventured forth. I pretty much wanted to get the story out, get their story down, and uncover this underreported part of history and bring it out, you know, into the light, and let people know about some of the things that happened back then that not many people really knew about, hadn't been talked about.
You know, Greg, in this day of information sharing and the internet and Snapchat and everything else that happens just so instantaneously, why do you think that it's taken until now, or taken, you know, so long after all of this has happened, to have stories like yours come out?
Well, I think at the time, during the 1940s, Stalin was in cahoots with Hitler for a while, until Hitler, you know, bombed Russia or attacked Russia in the summer of 1941. And then pretty much that's when Stalin said, well, okay, I guess I'll join the Allies and, you know, we'll defeat Hitler together. So he came on over and joined the Allied forces, and that's what happened. But in the process, you know, Poland became a communist country. And even after the war, it really wasn't discussed much that Stalin deported 2 million people and sent them to slave labor. Yes, he freed them about 18 months later when he joined the Allied forces, because there was a treaty that was signed, a pact that was signed, stipulating that he had to let all these people go. But I think collectively as a group, they, those that went through it and those that were still in the country when it became, you know, a communist country, I think everyone was pretty much on survival mode. Like, how are we going to get by? How are we going to survive? So I don't think that they had the levity of rallying together, talking about this, getting it out. First of all, I don't think they could have really spoken about it that much until, you know, the early 90s, after communism fell there.
Yeah.
And so I think it's just, it's kind of sometimes evolution is big leaps and sometimes it's a slow crawl. And I think in this case, it may have been somewhat of a slower crawl. It's taken this amount of time since, you know, maybe 1989, 88, 89, for this particular part of history to you know, be revealed. And I'm not the only one that's, you know, revealing it. I'm now noticing that I'm like one part of an interesting kaleidoscope. If I look back in the last few years, there's a few documentaries that uncover some of this through different types of stories they're telling. And there have been some books, mostly academic books, that were written probably in the 80s, 90s, by those that survived. Very academia, though, I would say. Very great, though. But so I think now there's a shift, there's a sea change going on. Because let's face it, everyone knows what Hitler did to Jewish people, and everyone should. Mm-hmm. But it's not in the collective consciousness, it's not in the mainstream yet, how, you know, of Stalin's atrocities. People are not really fully aware of just how bad Stalin was. And if you kind of, not that, you know, like you do a tit for tat, but if you do a tally of those that were affected and killed, really, under each man, Stalin's, it depends on what sources you look up, but in his, from my research, it went up to like 40 million, up to 40 million. So including his own people,
wow.
Polish people, those that, you know, the Lithuanians and other people that it's like this, you know, from the time he kind of got in there and took charge and became in power, was in power. So yeah, it's taken an interesting amount of time for this to come out. I'm just, I'm grateful that it's coming out and people are now, you know, beginning to know about it, and that generation, those that are still from that generation and that survived it, are getting some sort of justice. Finding that a lot in some of the book talks I did here in Chicago, that there's a real hunger for these folks, for their stories to be heard, for their experience to be validated. I think the Jewish experience with the Holocaust afterward, there was sort of a unification that happened, is my sense. Everyone rallied together. They told stories. They got all that information out there. So there was somewhat of a collective healing, but I think it's very different with the other, I call it the other Holocaust, because people aren't really aware of it, because it really was, you know. So that said, you know, that's kind of heavy stuff, but there's a lot of levity and lightness, you know, in the book. I think people.
Can we talk about like your research, how you went about this, where you traveled to, the places you went to go see, people you talked to? What was that process for you?
The research happened. That evolved. I really felt overtaken by a lot of, you know, I felt possessed by these, like, I feel like I had that these ghosts had a house party inside the psyche of my soul, and then now they're gone. But I mean, I know that sounds crazy, but it really feels like I was haunted. It's really weird. But I interviewed my family members that were still, many of them, a chunk of them survived. I interviewed them. I tried to get their particular story down so I knew the timeline of it, and I knew where they went, from where to where. Like, you know, they were deported from Eastern Poland February 10th, 1940, sent to Siberia, were there for 18 months, wandered like refugees, ended up in the Middle East, to Uzbekistan, somehow got out with the Polish army, you know, in the fall of 1942. So, I mean, they had such an interesting survival story. So I interviewed them. I got their story down. Then I went to, I was walking around Stanford for many, many months in California, just admiring buildings. Oh, I like this. I like this. Oh, I like the Hoover, you know, observation, you know, tower. And I didn't know that the Hoover Library had the most extensive amount of research and documents.
Really?
About this particular part of history outside of Warsaw. So it was like right in front of my nose. So I found that out. I went in there. There's a really amazing foundation called the Kresge Siberia Foundation, which has an amazing website
that has really evolved, which lists survivor testimonies, but there's also pictures, there's also stories, there's also records of this particular part of history, similar to the, I would say, the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in a way. So I did, you know, I read up a lot on Stalin and just did a lot of research that way. So it's really through family interviews and research with that. I did have an opportunity to go back to Poland in the fall of 2012 with the idea and the intent of going into Ukraine, which was then Poland, and find out just get to the exact spot that they were taken from, because I thought that would be really very interesting. I wasn't able to get there, but I was able to find their original place of birth, because moved farther east into what is now Ukraine. And had they not done that, I don't know if we would actually be sitting here talking. So because I don't know if any of those events would have really happened to them in particular. So that was the extent of my research. And I was just going to tell a story about them. This happened to them. This was their thing. And a good writer and close friend, colleague of mine, who worked in Hollywood for some time and really kind of knew about story and storytelling. And she told me, she said, no, you should tell it from, you should also include you. It should be, you should tell it how you got this story and how it's affecting you. And I said, well, I'm not part of the story. She goes, oh, you are now part of the story, you know, and like in handing down, the information that my uncle had passed along to me so long ago, like about over 10 years ago, I'd somehow become part of the story. And she was right. So I wrote the book in a way where it's really my journey uncovering their journey. So you kind of get two journeys, theirs and mine. And I think mine, because I'm so kind of kooky, neurotic, mood swingy, California, sign searching, picking spiritual lint out of my navel constantly. Well, not 7 days a week, but
often enough, right?
Yeah. So somebody said it reads like an Eat, Pray, Love by way of a Polish Alex Haley. So I like that. I'll take that.
Some of the things that you've done after the book has been published have been really very touching to me. And you've had a couple of moments on book. You had somebody in Australia that I want you to talk about. You've also talked about, you know, the events and some of the people that you've met. Can you share a couple of those stories with us, Greg? By the way, everybody who's listening, this is Greg Archer. He's the author of the top 10 bestseller, Grace Revealed. He's talking about it now, but you can buy the book today. Just click the link that's on the show page that says click to buy Greg's book. I shouldn't do that, so it's going to be a rhyming challenge for me especially. But go buy his book tonight. But stories that you have from, after it's been published, Greg, what are some really touching things that have come up?
Thanks for asking. I there are about three of them quickly come to mind because they just happened in the last week and a half. I had two book events, and each one was really unique and different. The last one was just last Saturday, where these... This was gut-wrenching, but these I laugh, but, you know, you kind of have to add some levity. These Polish kids reenacted, like, these deportation scenes from somebody's experience. So if you can imagine, like, somebody bringing, like, you know, like a, like this sort of prop that they created of a box car that they would slide with, like, wooden wheels and stuff. And,
oh, my gosh.
And they're sort of reenacting this thing. It was a really, like, powerful event, because it was like you're seeing it live. It's not like it's a movie where you're a little bit detached from it, but it was like it was there, and they're reenacting the scene and being at the train station looking for bread and everything, and it was really powerful. And I think after I showed I had a little bit of a presentation, and then I spoke, and when I opened it up to people for comments or questions, I really found that's when it really hit me that there's a real hunger, like, for this particular part of history to be expressed more, to be told, to be talked about, from the survivors, and also those, like, in my generation, those who, either had family that went through it or know of, you know, they had neighbors whose parents went through that or something. When I, many people have come up to me, even friends have said, what do you mean your family went to Siberia and India and the Middle East, Middle East, India and Africa, and there were Polish orphans in Africa in the 1940s, you know, Polish refugees, and it's, nobody's really known this story. So I'm finding there's a real interest and a real hunger for that. So that's the most recent, I would say, like a couple weeks ago, through some, of course, serendipitous twist of fate. I just, like, I don't know how this happened, really. Somehow I got connected to somebody, an author connected me to somebody at the United States Memorial Holocaust Museum. And by chance, I had connected with this woman just before she was coming out to Chicago. She wanted to interview some of my family members, particularly my uncle, who remembered things more than my mother, who was younger, and my aunt, who it's hard to kind of coordinate with her. But so this woman came from the Holocaust Museum and did a taping all day. They are expanding the types of stories that they are telling to go beyond just the Jewish Nazi experience, but to include the experience of those who were affected by those who collaborated with the Nazis, which, you know, obviously includes Stalin. So now they're opening up a whole nother, you know, vast possibility for these types of stories to be told, which I think is really brilliant. So that was powerful. That's not even the word. I don't really have a word for it. But you could feel like, you know, I was in the room when, you know, the people came in, they set up things, the woman was talking, she was interviewing my uncle, he was sharing his experience. It was, you know, all looking very official, like CNN or something, you know, with the lights and all that. But it really felt as if some, like the gods up there had come into the room and was like rearranging history a little bit, like giving it sort of a twist of justice or something. It was really, really profound. So I think that was really really amazing. And last week I coordinated a vigil on the 75th anniversary of the mass deportations when they began, which is February 10th, 1940, here at the Copernicus Center in Chicago. And that too was quite, it's been a kind of an emotional ride these last 2 weeks. Now I think about it.
Yeah, you've been up and down.
It's been very, very, I don't have a word for it. It's been something. It's been very something. I don't think I've assimilated it yet. But that was just another mesmerizing event. There were, you know, kids' choir singing and another choir singing. And then there was a video presentation that I did and a talk by a priest and a talk by, you know, a politician. And survivors were there. They were honored. And it was really impactful, I think. So really good for the community. And the candles that we took outside were, there's actually train tracks behind the Copernicus Center. So if you can imagine, we lined up these candles to represent like train tracks. And there was, you know, thought and moment of silence and whatnot that happened. And yeah, pretty trippy, pretty deep, pretty powerful. So I feel like I've been put in the right place at the right time, and, you know, onward we all go. But I still am learning more about just how thirsty people, or some, you know, how thirsty the people are for this particular type of knowledge to come out. I mean, because knowing this, it hasn't really been that exposed. So it's surprising to be a part of it, but I'm actually grateful that I am, and I'm looking forward to learning more from, you know, in different communities. I go to California in March, and I'll connect with different communities there as well for different book events and things like that. So
any thoughts about turning this into a screenplay or something adapted for the big screen?
Sure. I think yes, absolutely. I think a production company should. I've been connecting with a few people. yes, right now.
Yes.
I think it'd be, I mean, it lends itself to, I mean, and I wrote it in a way where it's really kind of, it's like somebody could pick it up and go, hey, this should be a movie. And it really should, because they're particular, all the people that survive that have a unique, interesting survival story. And I was really just mesmerized by my own family's survival, how they managed to do it, and the things that happened along the way that were just seemingly random events that if they were not there, things would have been so much different. So I can definitely see it as a movie. I am connecting with several individuals, and there's been some talk about that and movement moving forward, and I hope to keep going with that momentum. And once I get back into California, I think that that looks like it might be a little stronger. So,
good for you.
We'll
That's
see.
Awesome.
We'll see.
I love it.
You know, who knows?
Greg, you've been generous to give us about a half an hour of your time tonight. So as we get ready to wrap up, are there any other things that you want people to know about your book, Grace Revealed, that you can also buy on Amazon or wherever fine books are sold tonight? And or do you want to send any shout-outs to anybody before I let you go?
Well, let's see. What would I say? I would say, you know, this book would appeal to anybody that has been interested in where they came from and what their family has gone through, or you know, a part of or history. I think if you really like getting into a story that, you know, follows somebody's befuddled quest to find out the truth, you'll probably dig this story and get a whole lot of information about history too. So yeah.
There we go. Well,
that's
Greg,
what I'd
it's
say.
A pleasure. I can't wait to see you when you get out here in March. So we'll have to block an afternoon and go have lunch and, you know, gossip and stuff like that.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure to be on the show. Thank you.
Hey, thank you so much. Everybody, we're going to be right back with my interview with Jim O'Hare next. But first, listen up for Joseph Eads. This is his current hit single called Hit Me Up. We'll be right back. Thanks, Greg.
And round on my dance floor, but I know how you love to spin your mind before you let go. Don't let indecision make you cold. It'll hold you up and fold you up and make you grow old. But I'm gonna make it easy. You know you got me. Don't make it harder if you want me. Don't think it over, just come on over. Hit me up, hit me up, hit me up, hit me up. Too shy to walk in my door, but I know all your hesitation, cause I've been there before. Don't let indecision waste your time. Stop resisting your indecision. Come meet mine. Make a decision. You know you got. Want me, don't think forever. To hit me up, hit me up, hit me up, hit me up.
Welcome back to the show. As I've been telling you all week long, we have got the star of stage and screen, Jim O'Hare, joining the show today to talk about a new project that he's in, but you'll always remember him from his show Parks and Recreation. And I have questions about his Christmas movie. It looks like a legacy that he's starting to build right now as well. But Jim, welcome to Rated G Radio. How are you today?
Good, Garrett. How are you doing? Thanks for having me.
I'm so excited that you are here. You and I met back in December at the TMI show up at TMI Hollywood, and
yeah.
Was that something that was new and exciting for you? Is that something you've done before?
Garrett, as far as done before, I've certainly, I trained at Second City and you know that kind of thing. But I had no idea what I was in for. because John Barra, contacted me because he kind of handles the booking of the guest house, I guess. And he said, would you do it? And it was just, the timing is the tough part always to commit to because of, bookings and all this kind of stuff. Well, finally, he said, listen, if you can come take a look at it. I went and the host was Dot Jones.
Yeah.
And so I went and saw it, and I thought, wow, that looks really scary, but it kind of looks fun. But I'm going to blow this off, and I'll tell him I'll do it after the new year. So I'm like, John, and I wasn't lying. I had a lot of stuff going on. So I get an emergency message from him saying, listen, some people from Second City Chicago are coming in town. There's any way you could do it this one particular Sunday. And I thought, oh, hell, okay. And I said yes. And I tell you, here's what's amazing. They do that show every week. And every week, every scene is new. Every scene is topical. I was blown away by every aspect
talented.
Of it. They're a talented group of people, writers, directors, the whole thing. I was blown away.
It's such a cool show to see, and it's like you said, it's fresh every week. So I don't get up there every week, but I try to go as often as I can because it's just a fun look at the week's events, and you see so many talented people there. So John, from TMI, of course, is a dear friend of mine, and I think he's just the cat's pajamas. But having you on, everybody after the show, which is what really I just found so inspiring about what you were doing during your performances. Everybody's like, Jim was great, Jim was great, Jim was great, and I know that. You were saying, well, I don't know about this or that, and everybody's like, he was magical.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, you know what it is? They go out of their way to make the host look good. So, I give them all the credit because just to give people an idea of what happens, on Friday night, you're sent, I think it was 50 or 60 pages of material that they're going to do over they're going to do these scenes. Now, you're certainly not in on every page. You're not in every scene. But as the host, they put you, in a chunk, in a nice big chunk.
Yeah.
And that weekend also happened to be the Parks and Recreation wrap. That's when we wrapped up. Oh, actually, that reminds me. The reason I thought this timing was good, I thought it would take my mind off of, that Parks was just wrapping up. And it gave me something else to think about. So, but the Saturday night was our big wrap party, which I knew would be a little booze, a little food, all that kind of stuff. So I didn't know how much free time I would have. So Friday night I get these scripts. I'm like, holy cow, this is a lot of material. And you have to know it. It's not like there's no cue cards. This isn't, there's no monitors. There's, you got to know this stuff. But you go to rehearsal on Saturday. You meet the nicest group of people who go out of their way to make you look good. They know them. I mean, they're learning the material too, but you can tell they're focused on making the host look good. So I couldn't have been more appreciative. And so Saturday at one point I said, I don't think this can come together by tomorrow. I just don't think this is physically possible. And the one, I forget which one of the guys it was, and he goes, oh, feels this way every week, and then somehow it comes together. And that's exactly what happened. As much as I was like, this can't happen, there's no way that these 20 scenes are going to be in front of a crowd tomorrow. This is not physically possible. We did it, and I don't think anyone messed up a line. I think it seemed flawless. They were much better than I was, but they made me look good, which was just very lovely of them.
Well, and speaking, well, so TMI Hollywood, want to send mad props out to you guys, but speaking of your cast party that you're wrapping up the day before, so everybody knows you from your role as Jerry on Parks and Recreation, and I asked some people right before the show, I said, if you've got any questions for, you know, Jim to ask about his experience on there, send them on in. So I've actually got a couple from the listeners out there that they're going to hear this a little bit later this week. Is it? Can I ask you a couple of questions about your time?
Absolutely.
Did you want the part of Jerry, or did you audition for other parts before you were cast in that role?
Well, you know, when the word came out that Amy Poehler was going to do a show, because she had left Saturday Night Live,
mm-hmm.
so she was a hot property. And I think NBC wanted to keep her in the family because she was, you know, NBC Saturday Night Live. And so the word was out she's going to do a show with the co-creator of actually the creator of the American version of The Office, Greg Daniels. So it was kind of like, wow, Amy Poehler's having a show. That's going to be a big deal. So now it comes time they're going to cast it. So basically what they did was they put out for the role of Ron Swanson. So everybody and their brother read for the role of Ron
sure.
Swanson, which the thought of anyone else doing it other than Nick Offerman, like, just makes no sense.
Now it makes no sense, right?
I mean, in any realm, it makes no sense. And ultimately, he was always their choice. But the way these networks run, they want you to see everybody. It's a process, you know, it's the whole thing. So I'm a big believer in just being prepared for an audition because as an actor, that's my job. You know, like, I don't go into an audition unless I'm prepared, which that doesn't mean I don't screw up sometimes because, you know, that's human nature. But in general, I'm prepared because you never know who's in the room and what they might see
right.
and what they're casting
yeah.
next week or next month or something. So I went there. I did my interpretation of Ron Swanson, which was different than Nick's.
Mm-hmm.
So mine was more mine was stern, but a little less. A little less strident, or, you know, just a different take. But apparently they liked something they saw because I think it was 2 weeks later, my agent called and says, they want to see you for a different role. Would you want to go in? I said, of course. So I go in for Jerry, and when I got to the room, to the audition area, there was, you know, again, a ton of people and different types, body types. I'm like, oh, boy, you know, so they don't
uh-huh.
know exactly what they're looking for. So I went in the room, I did the Jerry thing, and then, you know, as an actor, you got to let auditions go because if you obsess over each and every one of them, you'd never sleep. You know, there's so many, and you have to learn early on that it's so out of your hands why you get cast or why you don't get cast. You might have given the best performance, but maybe you look too much like someone else or maybe,
right.
who knows, there's a million reasons why
yep.
you do or don't get the job. So a couple weeks later, I get a call, and they said, oh, you booked Parks and Recreation, and I said, well, what did I book? Like, what role? And anyway, so it was Jerry. And they were very honest up front. They said, it's not a series regular. I found out later Mike Shore and Greg Daniels, who ended up co-creating it, basically said, let's put him at a desk. We think it'll work. You know, we'll figure it out later.
Right.
So they hired me, and I never missed an episode. I didn't become a series regular, though, until season 3. So the first season was only 6 episodes, and then season 2 was a full season. So I became a full-on in season 3. So it was one of those things where they could have at one point said, you know what, this really isn't going to work, and you're done. You know, thank
right.
you for your time.
Yeah.
But my thought process the whole time was that these are the guys who worked on The Office, and look what happened to those guys. Your Kevin
right.
and your
yeah.
Phyllis's and Stanley and, you know, Angela's and all those people. So
great characters.
To me, it was great characters. They're beloved. You know, we love those characters. So to me, it was a pretty safe bet. That being said, it could have blown up and been like, no, this didn't work out. But luckily, very, very luckily it did. But when you hear stories, everybody read for different parts. Adam Scott had originally read for Mark Brandanowicz.
Wow.
I think Nick might have read for that role, too. So it was all over the place. The only one that was offered the job, obviously Amy, but Aziz they wanted. There was no Aziz was a pick. And
okay.
they got a call from the casting director saying, I just met the quirkiest girl. I want you to meet her. And Mike Shore says he met with Aubrey Plaza, and by the end of the meeting he knew he had to have her cast, and he was afraid of her. And he'll tell you, 7 seasons later, he's still afraid of her. You know,
yeah,
in a
there
good
you go.
Way. In a good
in
way.
A good
very
way.
Loving way. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Well, that question came from Nolan, and he had a follow-up question. How did the role change your life?
Wow. Oh, boy, Garrett. It changed in so many ways. You know, I mean, and just base facts, it changes your life financially. You know, to be a series regular changes things. I've been very, very blessed, and ever since I've moved to L.A. in 94, I've never had to do anything else, you know, to make a living. I've always made enough to live off of as an actor. But, you know, good years, bad years, some years really tight, you know, up and down. So it's security. You know, if nothing else, it gives you security. And we were very blessed. We made syndication, which means, you know, there'll be some, you'll see money from
nice
it as,
checks.
You know,
yep.
as years go on. Yeah, so that's awesome. But that's that little part of the world, which is, you know, people say, oh, money doesn't buy happiness. It absolutely doesn't, but it gives you some security. So that's one big thing that came from it. The other thing is it's opened up so many doors for my career. You know, my manager calls with offers sometimes rather than auditions. You know,
that's a nice change.
That's a nice change. You know, I'm shooting Hot in Cleveland next week, or well, this week, I guess it is. And they just called and said, we'd love to have Jim on our show. You know, so it's changed that. I have some films coming up that were offers. It's changed that. Now, that being said, I'm more than happy to audition as an actor. That's our job, like
sure.
I said earlier. So I don't mind going in and auditioning. But certain roles, they're just going to offer now instead of making me go in. And that's a big change. And also, I get to go to some good, cool parties.
That's always fun.
That's always
so
fun.
Out of all the episodes that you have filmed for Parks and Recreation, this is my last question. We'll move on to something else. Do you have a favorite episode or one that just really stands out in your mind?
Well, I have so many favorite episodes. Here's what I'm going to say about Parks that some people will agree or disagree. But the seasons, in my opinion, did nothing but get stronger. I don't think we had a weak season. And I can say that. I am not a writer. So that's not a bragging thing for me. I didn't do it. It wasn't because of me. But every season, I think it got stronger. So in season two, we did an episode called The Hunting Trip. And it was the first time all of us as a group were out in the world. We went on a hunting trip together. And I love that episode. It turns out Ron gets shot in the head with some weird stuff. And Retta, you know, who plays Donna, her Mercedes gets a hole in. I mean, I think everyone got to shine. And I just remember shooting it thinking, I'm living the dream this week. First of all, not knowing if we'd be on the air next month or not, you know, who knows,
right,
television.
Right.
But I remember thinking, I'm on a set with these amazing people. I have a chunk of the storyline. You know, as an actor, you love that you're part of a storyline. So I always say Hunting Trip. But then we had amazing, like the Harvest Festival episode where we made the Harvest Festival happen. Of course, I have personal favorites that I had good storylines in when I dropped a burrito and pretended I was mugged and, you know, there's all that kind of stuff. But I can also tell this is for the diehard fans. I think the finale, and again, I'll have people disagree, will be the finest hour that people have seen in a long time. I really believe that. And it airs February 24th.
And that's just coming right up this next, I don't know the calendar, but it's coming up. So we'll make sure to tune in for that.
On Tuesday, it's an hour long. And what they did, how they are treating each character is so lovely. And the thing about Parks is that I think is different from a lot of sitcoms. There's a lot of love in our show. There's a lot of, it's okay to go to a commercial break without a big laugh. Everything wasn't liner. And believe me, I love sitcoms, so I don't mind those other shows, but I think this is what makes Parks different. That it wasn't all about laugh, laugh, laugh. And so I think what they've done with and I'm a big TV guy, I always have been, I think what they've done with the finale is unlike anything I've ever seen on a sitcom. So it'll be interesting. I'm dying to hear people's feedback because maybe I'm overstating it, but because I am very close to it, obviously. But it's awesome. It's just really awesome.
Well, I can't wait to see it. And I know everybody, when I said we're going to have Jim on from Parks and Rec, they started freaking out, and I'm getting private messages all over the place. So I have a feeling it'll set records for ratings, and I'm sure NBC will love that. Now, I'm going to say, you know, I looked up your IMDb page, and I had to take a nap about four times through the first page just from all of the work that you're doing. And I was like, oh, poor Jim, you know, he's done with the series, the poor guy, you know, he's probably – and then I pull this up, and it's like, I don't think you've slept in about 15 years. So how do you have such a robust career? Because I know that if anybody's listening, you've seen Jim in millions of things. But the two things I really want to ask are about Naughty and Nice and My Santa – because you worked with my friend Sam Irvin, who's the director for those.
Oh, you know Sam. I love Sam Irvin.
He's the best.
He's the best. He directed, I did a series, in, I think it was 2000, two seasons of a show called Strip Mall. And that's how I got to know Sam, because he directed a bunch of them.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
He's just a sweet man. Oh, my God, I love him.
So much fun. So are you now going to be Sam's official Christmas go-to guy when he gets ready to do his next film this next year? I'm assuming he's going to, you know, he's done like four of these now. So
exactly. Well, he has said that he needs me at least even for a moment in each one of them. He's calling
okay.
me his good luck charm. I would love it. When Sam calls, I try to make it happen because he's the best. And people don't get it. But, I mean, people who are not in the, you know, who work on this day-to-day don't really understand. A director is so important to a project. It's their vision. And the tone that the director sets on a set is just so vital. And Sam is so even-keeled, and yet he puts out the fires. He handles the actors. He gives his notes. You know, maybe we do this, maybe we do that. But the tone and the feeling he puts on a set, you just want to work with him. He's one of the best.
Well, I love anything that the guy does. So I'll tell you that he's a favorite of mine, and then to be able to know him outside of his work, just a real treat. Now, the reason that I've asked you here today, though, and amidst your busy schedule, because we really had to kind of juggle and try to find time to fit you in, because you're a working actor, and you don't stop working. But you've got this fantastic new project called Middleman. And can you tell the listeners what that's all about?
Yeah, Middleman is a script that a friend of mine wrote a lot of years ago with me in mind, which was very awesome of him to do. His name is Ned Crowley, and he's a guy I knew in Chicago and did comedy with in Chicago, and we've been dear friends for, my God, going on 30 years. So last year he got back to me, you know, he was mentioned to me, he goes, I got this weird call, and there's these people who want to produce Middleman. And I said, wow, where did that come from? Like, wow, you know, I'm surprised. And he said, yeah, but only if you'll do it. And that made me even more surprised. Like, wow, that's very nice. So we met with these people, these producers, and we're going to do it. It's a low, you know, it's a low budget indie. It's about a guy who has lived mostly with his grandmother. His parents died when he was young. He's lived with his grandmother, and he was raised on not today's comedians. He was more raised on Burns and Allen and Abbott and Costello, you know, those kind of
sure.
You know, he could, like how some people can, you know, lip sync to song, he can lip sync to every word of a Burns and Allen sketch or of Who's on First, you know, classic comedy stuff. So his grandmother always encouraged him, said that he was very funny. Well, he's not. He's not funny at all. But she passes away, and the only thing she had left to leave him was a car. It's this old, beautiful 58 Chevy. And he's going to, kind of in her honor, fulfill a lifelong dream, and he wants to go to Vegas and become a stand-up comic. There's a guy called Monty Guy who holds an annual comedy competition, and he's going to go there, and he's going to just, you know, take it by storm. Well, on the way there, he runs into a very mysterious hitchhiker, and things take a very bad turn. It's a very, very dark comedy. There's lots of blood. But it's funny and crazy. But he ends up being involved in things he never would even understand in his normal world, because he's just this sweet, innocent little guy, and now he's involved in murders and cover-ups and everything. So it's a very exciting film, and the script has gotten so much great attention that there's like name actors who want to be involved, which has been so exciting. You know, you get a call that so-and-so wants to be in the film. You're like, holy cow. So we can't release a lot of the names yet just because contracts haven't been signed, but there's,
right.
you know,
as
we joke,
right.
yeah, as we joke in the promo for the Kickstarter campaign, we're like, famous people, you know. So, which is exciting. My Parks family, of course, has been very supportive, and hopefully we'll see some of those faces. So it's a film that we're just so excited about, and I'm excited for many reasons. One of them, it's the anti-Jerry. You know, I've played this sweet, lovable man, you know, with this beautiful wife and family at home and all this on Parks for a lot of years. This is the anti-Jerry. This guy, you know, like I said, it turns into a bloodbath, and he has a love interest. So the movie we think it's going to be, we can shoot it in 25 days. It's a low budget indie, but we're doing a Kickstarter campaign to raise money. And people, a lot of times, and I totally understand this, people are like, well, you've been on a TV show. This should just be your money, blah, blah, blah. Here's what I say. It is my money, and it's Ned's money, and it's a lot of our money. We put a lot of money. Everyone's put money in.
Right.
We want to make a low-budget film look like a really big-budget film. So we did a Kickstarter campaign for another $150,000. So we started last week, and you can get some great things from it. You can have a walk-on in the film. You can go to the premieres. God, for the big donation, I come to your house, and we have a pizza and beer party. So
you can't
as we
beat
watch
that.
The movie. Can't beat that. So that's to watch the movie. So it's just it's a way to keep people involved. You know, for their donation, they get to be involved in the film. There'll be emails. There'll be blogs every day. There'll be pictures, videos from me and the other stars that are going to be in it. The one guy I think I can talk about, and even though when I say this, I could be getting in trouble because I don't know if all the paperwork is done, but there's a guy named Andrew J. West, and he's from Walking Dead. And he's got a huge fan base. He's going to play my co-lead. And he's just amazing. We did a chemistry test a couple weeks ago, and wow, he's awesome. So super excited about that. And the woman who's going to play my the female interest in the film, I can't say her name yet. I'm dying to say it. I can't wait to say it, but I'm not allowed to yet. But we'll be announcing on the Kickstarter page, we'll be announcing as these people are officially signed up, we'll be announcing their names, and then, you know, people can get excited.
And RJ wants to know, what have you got completed so far as filming? It looks like you've got
teasers. Yeah, no, we shot teasers to get. What we wanted to do with the teasers was to show people this is the style of this film. And the teaser, if you go to middlemanmovie.com, it will lead you right to the Kickstarter page, and you can see the teasers. It's also on YouTube. If you type in Jim O'Hare Middleman, you can take a look at some of these teasers. I think they're so well done, and it gives a great feel of what this film is going to look like. It actually almost looks like a period piece, but it's not. It's set present
day. Well, is it because of the car?
It's because of the car and because of the way Jerry dresses. Again, he's lived with his grandmother all of his life. He is not of today's world. He wouldn't know about Twitter and Facebook, and he would certainly wouldn't know how to do a Vine or a selfie. You know, Jerry would have Lenny, the character's called. Lenny would have no knowledge of any of that. So he is from the old days, but it's all set present day. So basically, you know, it's so funny because I get it, and I never down anybody who, I know money's tight for people and all that kind of stuff. That's why we're trying to make the incentives as exciting as we can to make it worthwhile. Because if everyone even just gave $5 who follows my Twitter or my Facebook, we'd be way up and over. You know, but to say just $5, that's not fair either. For a lot of people, that's a chunk
$5
of money.
I
get it. So I don't ever, but what we're saying basically is if you can't give financially, if you just help us spread the word.
That's a great thing to do. Jim, real quick, one last question. Is there anything else you want people to know about you and your career and your time here on Earth?
Well, you know what? I can tell you I've been incredibly blessed. I've had, and not just with the career, I have a family that is unmatchable, brothers and sisters, parents who are gone now but who never let me down as far as my dream was important to them, even though I don't think they understood it all the time. They were always at every opening night. They were always at everything I ever did. They were always there. And that kind of support is huge. The other thing I would also say is live your dream if you can live it. And I know it's easy to say because I've had a lot of, you know, good opportunities happen, but there was a lot of years it didn't happen. And I just stuck it out. And so I just always say stick it out. I'm not saying live in the street to make your dream comes true, but, you know, just keep your eye on the prize.
There we go. Everybody, it's been Jim O'Hare. His new movie is called Middleman. He's doing a Kickstarter campaign right now to fund this. Go click the link on the show page. Give $5, give $100, give $10,000, whatever you can afford to give, and we'll be right back after this. Thanks, Jim.
Garrett, thanks.
How cool was that to have Jim O'Hara on the show tonight to talk about his movie Middleman? I hope you go out and support it. The link on the show, of course, takes you right to the Kickstarter page, so go and donate. And the cool thing about Kickstarter is that you're just like, well, geez, they're asking for money and I don't get anything for it. There's all kinds of different levels, like Jim was telling about, from $1 to $5 to $10,000, and you get your different levels of perks. So, and it's usually if you spend $1, you get this. If you get $5, you get a new $5 reward and what you would get at $1. Then you give $25, you get the $25 reward and what you get at $5 and what you get at $1. So it's kind of like a building thing. So if you've never explored that or thought about it, this might be something fun for you to do. And plus, it's a piece of movie cinematic history. I think this movie is going to be great. If you take a look at the stills and the information that's on the Kickstarter page, I think you will be engaged. Thanks to Mary Lou, who is listening in today and chatting in the Blog Talk chat room. I want to send a big shout-out to all the people who are listening in live tonight, including Angela, Mark, another Mark, Paul, Wesley, Michael, Patrick, Evan, Natalie, John, Greg, Mary Lou, George, Tasha, Kelly, Danny, Richard, Robbie, Joseph, Mary. I've got Sue. I've got Linda in Wisconsin, and everybody else. So thanks for everybody who's pinging me while the show is going live. We're going to be back tomorrow on Thursday with Kurgan Edward Stout. He is an author, a father, a husband, and we're going to be talking about events that are occurring in the world today. And then Friday night, we've got a very special VIP guest with Aralee Brighton. She's a singer, songwriter, and she is a worldwide known phenomenon for voicing and being part of the Xbox game phenomenon. But she is going to be releasing a world premiere single on the Friday Night Dance Party that is exclusively being played here first. I can't wait to share it with you. It's her song, Unbroken. And we're going to talk to her about her journey through music and life and all the things that she's doing to be just a bright light in this world. So this is a little Patrick Allen Casey, Hero, from his album 40 Days, 40 Nights, recent guest on the Friday Night Dance Party as well. We will see you live on Thursday. Don't drive distracted and have a great night.
Listening to Rated G Radio.